That which does not kill me makes me stronger, said Nietzsche. But of course, a lot of the time it did kill you.
Yes, yes, exactly. It kills you part of the time.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I'm going to take you behind the scenes at the Bulwark today. I'm talking with my great colleague, Jonathan Cohn, about his beat, which is all deep dives on policy matters. And he focuses a lot on health. And this is a particular interest of mine. And honestly, going back to the beginning of the second Trump administration, I remember thinking that of all the horrors and depredations that this administration was going to visit upon us, maybe one of the most galling and one of the hardest to tolerate was the complete degradation of public health and the choice of RFK Jr., a crank, to lead our most important health agency in the government that has such an incredible role. Anyway, that struck me as one of the most pernicious acts in this presidency. But of course, there's so much competition. But Jonathan, I want to check in with you on how this is all going. You keep a close eye on what's happening at HHS. And I think it's fair to say that there has been, they've hit some bumps in the road in their effort to kill us all.
Yeah. Yeah, they have. Thank God. So can I actually start with like a Bulwark behind the scenes note? So first of all, I don't know if you know this, we are coming up on my 1 year Bulwark anniversary, or whatever we call it.
Congratulations.
Exactly. Thank God. I love it here. Love working with you and everybody here. It's wonderful. And it's funny, you know, you described the newsletter I write, the breakdown, as about being policy, which it is. It's a broad mandate to do all kinds of policy. And, you know, I always knew I was going to be writing a lot about health because it's what I know best. It's what I've written the most about. But I honestly thought that, you know, when I started this, that, you know, it would be a mix of about half, maybe getting closer to 2/3 on healthcare, and then, you know, using the rest to cover other topics that we're all interested in. And it's basically been, you know, occasionally I get to do something else. This past week I wrote about electric vehicles and EVs, the gas crisis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But mostly it's on health because of what you said. It's because it's been a 5-alarm fire since day one, since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Took over. And it's, I mean, again, like you said, it's so typical of the Trump administration. It's just this flood of nonstop, constant news. And just when you think you're on top of one thing, it's something else. Although, as you said, we are at this interesting moment where Kennedy is still in charge of HHS. They are still pushing forward with his agenda. He is still pushing forward with his agenda, but he's now run into some roadblocks. And if you want, you know, we can talk about what those are.
Yes, 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 I do.
There's definitely been a pushback.
But that's the good news. So before we get to the good news, let's sort of set the scene a little bit with what we're dealing with. So I just printed out something that I think sort of speaks to how much the world has changed, how much these people have done to change reality. And so I was looking up what happened when the Salk polio vaccine was found after, you know, everybody knew it was coming, but it was like, would they find that it was safe and effective? Right. And this is the description that I pulled up, and it's just so amazing. So 500 people, including 150 press, radio, and television reporters, filled the room. 16 television and newsreel cameras stood on a long platform at the back. 54,000 physicians sitting in movie theaters across the country watched the broadcast on closed circuit television. And it goes on. Robert Redford, who was 11 years old at the time and a victim of polio. I did not know that.
I did not know that either.
Called it earth-shattering news. Europeans listened on Voice of America. And Paul Offit, who was one of the first guests on my podcast, who is, as you know well, he's a virologist, and he's the discoverer of a vaccine himself. Anyway, he said, The results were clear. The vaccine worked. Inside the auditorium, Americans tearfully and joyfully embraced. By the time the spokesman stepped down from the podium, church bells were ringing across the country. Factories were observing moments of silence. Synagogues and churches were holding prayer meetings, and parents and teachers were weeping. One shopkeeper painted a sign in his window, "Thank you, Dr. Salk." I mean, that was the reaction of the country to that vaccine. And it was very justified. I remember my parents telling me about what their childhoods were like when their parents wouldn't let them go swimming. They wouldn't let them, you know, go to public places in the summer because they were so terrified of catching polio. And a lot of the time it was spread in pools, apparently. And so people were just so grateful. And, you know, and now fast forward, you know, we have all of these life-giving vaccines that have spared so many people death, terrible injuries, et cetera. And we have these quacks who are convincing people that it's the vaccines that are going to make you sick, not the diseases that the vaccines protect you from. And, okay, so that's the scene. Let's talk about some of the highlights of this past year with Kennedy. So he didn't, one of the things you and I talked about last time was we were convinced that he was going to come out with some statement that, you know, the MMR vaccine, which is a common broad spectrum vaccine for children, measles, mumps, rubella, that he was going to say this causes autism, which he's been arguing for decades. Instead, they threw us a curveball. What was this business about Tylenol and pregnant women? Tell us that story.
Oh my gosh. Yes, they did. They did throw us a curveball. So, I mean, if you remember, there was a big to do. He announced that they were going to, it was an announcement, and I can't remember. You know, it's funny. I don't know about you, but I have trouble now remembering exactly which announcement, which was, I can see them all in my head, but it's like, you know, it was March and April. It wasn't that long ago, but there's so much. But my recollection is there was an announcement with the White House, or at least it was
with Trump
that they were going to find, you know, originally it was, we're going to find the cause of autism.
So that was how they presented it. Yeah.
And we're going to have it by September, which right away, if you understand anything about science, should have been just giant alarm bells right there, because that's not how science works.
No.
You know, like, I'm going to discover the secure to our energy crisis in 6 months. Okay, well, all right, sure. I'm going to discover the cure for cancer. I mean, whatever. That's not how it works. And I do think, you know, it's hard for me to know what Kennedy and his allies truly believe as to what they were saying publicly. Did they believe that, you know, in the bowels of you know, they've often claimed that HHS is sitting on data that would prove the autism link. And I don't know, maybe some of them really believed it and they got into it. The period comes and goes. They haven't found anything. And so then they roll out this announcement on Tylenol, in which they say there's strong evidence that Tylenol may be linked to autism. And of course, Kennedy makes his statement, and then Trump gets up and starts, you know, going even beyond Kennedy, right? Like, don't ever take Tylenol. My God, don't do it. Do anything you can do to avoid, which actually was slightly, I mean, even Kennedy had a slight bit of couching, like, well, you know, we think there's a signal here. We need to be much more careful with it. And Trump's just like, don't take it. You're going to give your kids autism. And I don't know about you, I immediately got flashbacks to COVID when he was, you know, making the press conference and making all kinds of wild, unsubstantiated arguments.
Absolutely.
And of course, it was classic for how things go, because there was the press conference and then there was official guidance put out. But the official guidance was actually much more carefully worded than even what Kennedy had said, because clearly that had gone, you know, what goes out in writing, you know, it has to go through layers of lawyers and has to run certain bureaucratic traps. And Kennedy has eliminated a lot of those, but there's enough there to kind of force some scientific integrity on whatever they put out. And so that message went out and Trump said that. And meanwhile, I mean, the postscript to that story is, and I can't remember when this was, not too long ago, we had another big meta study looking at all the evidence on Tylenol, because, you know, the origins of this was that, you know, years ago, there were some, you know, autism is complex. We're trying to figure out what causes it. And there were some signals somewhere that maybe there was some association with Tylenol, acetaminophen, which is, you know, and during pregnancy. And they did a new big giant study. They said, nope, don't see it there, not there. And of course, that is what we've generally seen with these studies now. Did Kennedy say anything today? Of course not. There's been no acknowledgement of that. So meanwhile, we have data to show that use of acetaminophen and Tylenol went down among pregnant women right after this announcement, which just goes to show you, you know, you could argue, well, at the end of the day, you know, this is, they're not talking about it anymore and we've got a new study out. Well, yeah, but you can see, you know, there's this lingering, people listen to this, you know, people listen, you know, when your president says something or the secretary of health, and you know, you and I, we follow this stuff. It's our job to follow this stuff. Not everyone does. People are busy. And you know, when you're a parent, especially, you get nervous, or you know, you're pregnant, you're expecting, you're so nervous. And I understand that completely. I was a neurotic father when my kids were little and my wife was pregnant. So I get it. It's going to cause doubt.
As with all things, I mean, there, Thomas Sowell used to say, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And one of the things that happened, I mean, that could have happened, I mean, so it, as far as we know, with the state of scientific knowledge right this moment, if I understand it correctly, is that Tylenol is the safest pain reliever to take during pregnancy. And sometimes it is necessary. And that if you don't take it, like to reduce fever in a pregnancy, you can cause other problems to your unborn child. And if the fever is really, you know, hard to wrestle back. And so what happens is, like, there are a bunch of pregnant women forwent Tylenol, but what did they do in, maybe they took acetaminophen, I mean, maybe they took ibuprofen instead. We don't know, but that is more toxic, more dangerous to unborn babies. And so, you know, it's like this ignorant, you know, bull in a china shop thing that they do. And then at that same press conference, they also, Trump also did, again, flashback to hydroxychloroquine from the COVID days. He also recommended leucovorin, which is a anti-cancer drug. And so a bunch of parents went out and bought that and bought it. It caused a shortage for the kids with cancer who really need it. So, you know, again, okay, brilliant. then there was the case. We are going to get to the good news, so I promise. Hang in there, guys. Then there was the business about the meningococcal disease and the vaccine for that. Why don't you tell us about that one?
Yeah, this is one I have strong feelings on this one. I spent a lot of time researching this, and it's you know, meningococcal disease is, if you talk to pediatricians, and by the way, I should say I'm not a doctor. So anybody, you know, listening to this, you're looking for vaccine advice, ask your doctor. You know, go to your healthcare professional. Don't, you know, I am not an MD, and I don't try to be an MD, unlike the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
right.
So, but meningococcal disease, if you talk to pediatricians, you talk to infectious disease specialists, it's their nightmare because it affects young, you know, children, young children, teenagers. It's rare. That's the good news. It's very rare. But when it strikes, you go from totally healthy. I mean, this is nothing that preys on people with weak immune systems or something like that. It can affect anybody. You go from completely healthy to in a full body crisis, basically, in 12 to 24 hours. I mean, there's nothing like it. And I don't have the figures at my fingertips. I want to say it's something like 10 to 20% of the people who get it will die with good medical care. This isn't, oh, you know, if we've gotten the, it is just, and a larger percentage will end up with disabilities, in many cases, amputations of extremities because of the way it affects circulation.
Can I interrupt to just quote you? Because in the piece you did about it, you quoted a doctor who said that one of the first things he ever did, I think as an intern or a resident, was taking care of a patient who had this disease. And it was a little boy, I think he was 7 years old, and he had these horrible rashes all over his body, and it was affecting his heart. And in order to keep his heart pumping, because I guess there was too much fluid, I don't know what it was. I'm not that obviously not a doctor either, but he had to inject calcium into the boy's heart to keep it beating. And he did this for something like 36 hours, every few hours, giving the boy a shot of calcium, and he died anyway. It was just heartbreaking.
It is just heartbreaking. And again, you know, you interview a pediatrician or an infection, they'll all tell you, you know, I saw this in residency. I saw this in training. I don't ever want to see one of those again. And these are people who do infectious disease. I mean, they're, yeah. I don't want to say they're jaded, but you know, they're vets. They've seen this stuff, and they'll all tell you, they're like, please, I don't ever want to see that again. And in fact, the story, I did a story on this, because there's an interesting story in France, which was a country that has, you know, been going through its own debates about vaccines, and where they ended up adding recently the meningococcal vaccine. And I remember speaking to, for my story, I spoke to these parents who had a very young baby die from it. And it was just tragic listening to their story. And it was, you know, baby seemed like they had the flu, and then they got into the clinic, and the clinic said, oh my God, we think this is meningococcal. They treated, they did the best they could. And it was the same thing, heart failure, and the baby died. We have vaccines for this now. We have a vaccine. It has been tested. It is safe. It is very effective vaccine. It really works. And we have brought down the number of cases of this very rare disease with the vaccine. We know where, you know, it tends to strike, it can strike young people, especially in communal settings. It's spread through the air. You would see outbreaks when you see them frequently in places like college dorms, military barracks. We have young people in sort of close quarters, nurseries, things like that. We have the vaccine. There is no reason not to give the vaccine. It's safe. It is effective. And, you know, you ask any physician, like, you know, you say, hey, you can, you know, they'll tell you, we can stop this. We don't need to take that risk. Yes, it is a small risk, but it is the most catastrophic risk you can imagine. I have a thing here. We can stop this. We can save these lives. Why wouldn't you use it? And we have, you know, pulled back.
So what did RFK, what did HHS do about this vaccine?
So what HHS did was, and this is where the France thing comes up, is in the very end of last year, and then, you know, leading up to early January, they announced that Kennedy announced that CDC, which is the part of HHS, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which recommends, it has a set of recommendations. We call it a vaccine schedule. These are the shots we recommend everybody get, the childhood vaccines, you know, everything from measles to polio, you know, including previously, there's two actually types of meningococcal vaccines. And CDC announced that going forward, the United States has had a vaccine schedule that basically had, depending on how you want to count, 17 or 18 vaccines that were part of the childhood schedule. So these were vaccines you got, you know, by the time you became an adult, and they were pulling them back to 11. So they were taking a half dozen off the list, including the meningococcal disease vaccine. Also, don't want to get this wrong. I haven't looked at the list recently, but I believe rotavirus, RSV, a couple others. You know, they kept measles. They kept chickenpox, which was one that was kind of going to go. There was some uncertainty whether they were going to go one way or another. And what was so interesting and so telling about the way this was done was the argument was, we looked abroad. This is what HHS said. This is what CDC said. We did a study of vaccines abroad, and we decided that we were out of step with the international consensus. So we have so many vaccines, we're gonna stop recommending these other vaccines, so we're closer in line with the international consensus. Among the many issues with that was, if you actually looked abroad, what you discovered was there are lots of countries, and there's a spectrum, and some have more, and some, you know, some have fewer, some have, you know, more vaccines on their schedule. We had been at the high end. 17 was, you know, at the very high end, but we were not alone. Germany, I think, had 16. There were a couple other, you know, large economically advanced democracies that were very close to us. And then there were some that were far less. And one in particular was Denmark. Denmark had 11. And they very explicitly cited Denmark as their model. They said, we want to be like Denmark. That's going to be our model. And you have to ask yourself, well, why Denmark? I mean, you know, Denmark, I've actually never been to Denmark, but I actually know a fair amount about it because I know about Scandinavian economies and their welfare states. seems like a great country. And I'm a big believer in learning from other countries. I'm sure there are lessons to learn from Denmark.
And Trump is in favor of invading their territories like Greenland. So there we go.
There you go, right? So, you know, we need to take Greenland away from them, but we want to copy their vaccines. And if you think about it for a second, okay, this is a country of 6 million people. 300. What are we up to? 330, 340 now?
So 340, I think. And, you know, that's New York has more people than that.
Right. New York City is bigger than Denmark. More diverse, a very different economy. And of course, we don't, you know, Denmark is, you know, for better or worse, depending on your opinion, but, you know, it is a social democratic paradise. I mean, they have cradle to grave, obviously health insurance, but also child. I mean, everything. I mean, this is, you know, the Scandinavian welfare state.
Yeah.
And, again, whether you like that or not, one of the upsides of us of that is that everybody like is watched pretty closely for their healthcare. And you can make a case that at least for some of these vaccines, you know, that can factor into your calculations of whether or not to give it early, because to some extent in this country, we are recognizing with our vaccine schedule that, you know, lots of people are going to fall through the cracks. They don't have health insurance. They don't have access to healthcare. We're going to miss stuff and they're going to get sick. So if the vaccine doesn't have a downside, you might as well get, I mean, you know, these are debates you can have. But, you know, at the very least, if you are going to look at other countries, presumably you wouldn't look at just Denmark. You would look at Germany, right, which is a much larger country, diverse. France, which is, you know, the third largest economy in Europe. Again, more diverse, more similar to us economically, demographically. You know, you'd look at places like Japan, and whatever, you'd go through the list. And what you would discover is that now we are actually out of step with the consensus. You know, we've gone from being at the high end to the low end. And really, when you look at the countries that are more like us, they're mostly clustered at the high end. So it really, it was a very, very specious argument.
And because of the MAHA movement having been elevated this way, and also because of the mood had already been moving against vaccination, even before Kennedy supercharged it, we've had a few outbreaks of measles in this country. Where do we stand on that? And this, by the way, it's so frustrating because, of course, most people get over measles if they get it. But a significant minority do not. And I mean, it kills people. It has already killed people in the second Trump administration. We'll get to that. But it also causes lifelong disabilities for other people, sometimes mental retardation, sometimes deafness, sometimes, what is that thing where it's like there's a, it causes the immune system to forget all of its
amnesia,
other immunities?
Immune, yeah,
yes,
it's like an
inverted
immune. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's one of the side effects. It can, your immune system can forget how to
fight other
disease. And there, you know, there's a, you know, you can get, there's a condition where you can get sick many years later. We just had a death in California a couple of months ago from someone who had measles, I think 10, 12 years before. Mm-hmm. And it's very scary. So there are all these complications. And you know, you can end up with all kinds of disabilities, like you just said. You know, again, most people, it's true, most people will get through the measles in 1 or 2 weeks. They'll be okay. Although just to be clear, I mean, not fun, the measles.
No.
Like it's not just a couple of, you know, little red welts and you sneeze. I mean, it's rough for 2 weeks, but
oh,
you know,
yeah.
Okay,
like, you know. So I had the vaccine. I think I'm just at the age where it was given to very young kids, but there were other kids. I knew about kids who had measles, and I remember knowing, because I did get chickenpox, which was still, there was still no vaccine for chickenpox.
Me too.
Oh, okay. And I remember people saying, you're lucky you're not going to get measles, because chickenpox is a breeze compared to measles.
Right. Right. So, that's right. That's right. And, you know, we had elimination status. I want to say it was 2001 or 2000. I keep forgetting the exact year.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Because of, we had, you know, enough people had gotten the vaccine and there was an adjustment realizing you needed a one and then a second, you know, needed one booster, et cetera. Now, elimination status doesn't mean there was never a measles case. It would pop up because it's still circulating in other parts of the world. Traveler mm-hmm. bring it back. There are breakthrough cases. They're rare, but they happen. And in addition, mm-hmm. you have some people who can't get the vaccine because they're immunocompromised in some way. They're very, very young. When you're a very young child, they don't, you know, they typically the first dose isn't given 1 or 2 years. I think I kind of looked that part up.
But you know what? That has changed. So
that
I
has changed.
I have a grandson now. But the fact is, like, my son and daughter-in-law decided to get him his measles, his first measles shot at 6 months instead of 12 months because it's out there. And it didn't used to be recommended at this young of an age, but now pediatricians are willing to do it because it's worth the risk. It's worth the trade-off.
Yeah. And again, I'm not a doctor, so you should ask your doctor about this, but I know that in South Carolina, where we've had an outbreak, it looks like it's finally tapering off. But we had about 1,000 confirmed cases in South Carolina. There was a big upsurge in vaccination. And a lot of pediatricians were doing exactly that. They were saying, even if you're 6 months, go ahead and get the shot now. So, you know, but when we had elimination status, and technically we still do, no one's taken away yet, you know, there would be a case now and then from a traveler would bring it abroad. But you had what we call herd immunity, which, you know, generally thought to be around 95% of the population having gotten the vaccination, there's no spread, right? It's a handful of cases and it dies out because there's no one for it to go to. Well, when you know, we are seeing in many communities across the country, vaccination fall below herd immunity, sometimes way below herd immunity. And, you know, for a reason, it could be a religious group, it could be people who, for whatever reason, culturally, this is a place where anti-vaccination sentiment has really grown, whatever the reason, and then it takes off. And the problem is, you know, again, this has happened before, and we did have occasional small outbreaks, but again, it would be one outbreak. Now, what we're seeing, we have this kind of continuous rolling set of outbreaks now. Last year was by far the most measles cases we'd had in 30 years, and we are easily on pace to break that this year. The South Carolina outbreak looks like it's done or about to be done, but there's cases in Utah, there's cases in Southwest Florida. I think there's some cases in Northern Florida. I know when those Northern Florida cases first popped up, there was concern that those were basically cases that more or less literally hitched a ride down I-95, you know, on some traveler driving down the highway. I don't know if they were able to prove that. Sometimes it's difficult to sort of establish these things quickly. But the point is, now when we get a case, it's not going to be one case, right? It's going to be 10, it's going to be 50. And if it can grow pretty quickly. And, you know, the Southwest Florida case is interesting because the outbreaks there were around a university. It was a religious university with a lot of people who'd been homeschooled and just, you know, associationally, people who tend to homeschool are more likely not to do vaccination. That's just the demographics, politics, et cetera. So it was confined to that university, but then what happens? You start seeing it outside. You know, is, you know, when someone went to the grocery store, there was a gym, whatever, and it starts popping up in around the community. And this is what happens when, you know, at that point the virus, you know, the measles is circulating, and at that point it's no longer eliminated. And that's why we are hearing a lot about the United States likely to lose elimination status sometime in the next.
And there
year.
Were 2 deaths of children in Texas. Is that right?
There were 2 deaths of children in Texas. I believe they're both confirmed to be unvaccinated. It's possible one was unknown vaccination status. But yes, 2 children, first child deaths in a long time. And again, that is tragic. That should not, a child dying. I mean, look, children die every day. We all live in the real world. We know that horrible things happen and there are things we can't prevent. But I think it is a mark of an enlightened society that says, when we can prevent a child death, that is the utmost importance. And we have the tools. We have the vaccine. It works. It's safe. And the idea that we have this in our arsenal and we're holstering it because of anti-vaccine sentiment that now has the blessing of the federal government, it's, if you care about public health, it's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, vaccines are a triumph. I mean, you know, I guess the next thing on their agenda should be to go after antibiotics. You know, another great blessing that the Enlightenment has brought us. But, you know, I guess maybe the conspiracy theorists will come along and say that they are responsible for, you know, depression or suicide or something. And, you know, I mean, that would be the equivalent of what they're doing here. But let's talk about the whole issue of trust, because you had a really good piece about the grandparents for vaccines, which was actually a little inspiring, honestly. I should sign up now that I'm officially a grandparent. But the whole question of trust, you know, you have these people, because of our information environment, who have, you know, become propagandized online, and they think the Maha moms, you know, they think they're doing what's best for their kids. And it plays into some themes. It's kind of funny that they all migrated over to the right. But these people who thought that, you know, chemicals bad, natural good, you know, used to be on the left. That was very much a left thing. And by the way, RFK Jr., you know, was kind of on the left for most of his career. It was a natural for him. And it was like, yeah, the reason we're unhealthy is that there are these chemicals that companies are pumping into our environment, and that's what's making us sick. And it's actually, you know, they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're doing the right thing for their kids. They think they're doing the right thing for society. And it is a tough thing to try to say, well, actually, like you talked about glyphosate. How do you pronounce that chemical?
Glyphosate, I believe.
Glyphosate? Okay.
Yeah. So I could be getting it wrong, though. It's been a while. When I wrote this story, because I've heard it a million times, but I've heard it different ways. And I remember looking it up, and now it's been a few weeks. I'm like, where did we land on that? So whatever.
Well, it's the chemical that's in Roundup, and it is, you know, kind of a boogeyman chemical. But, you know, it's a simplistic idea to say chemicals are always bad and natural is always good. I mean, and Kennedy falls into this trap all the time. Like, he doesn't even want pasteurized milk, right? That's not natural. It's better to drink, you know, unpasteurized raw milk from the cow. Well, actually, the unnatural way of dealing with milk, namely pasteurization, is much better, safer. And similarly, these chemicals, yes, they are artificial, but they also allow the risk from them is minuscule, like from Roundup. And it allows us to be incredibly productive with farmland. It allows the farms to be incredibly productive, which means it's better for the environment. Anyway, you talk.
I hear what you're saying on all of that. I mean, so my starting point for this, I will say, you know, and I try to interview everybody.
You do. You're very, very balanced. That's one of the great things about your pieces. They're always very well reported and balanced and informative and well written.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm, like I said earlier, I get being a parent's hard. It's scary. You want to do what's, oh, I've never met a parent who didn't want to do what was best for their kids. So, you know, I start with that sort of, you know, everybody wants what's good for their kids. They're trying to do the right thing.
Yes.
And the world's scary. And you're bombarded with messages, especially now with social media. It's, I see things on social media and I don't, you know, I try to do my due diligence on every one of these. It's hard. You know, you're busy. Yeah. You're a busy parent. You're working. You're changing diapers. You know, you remember you got a grandchild now, you know, you're up at all hours of the night. You're like, you know, you're like, whatever. It's tough stuff to be a parent. So I'm very sympathetic. And, you know, I think number one, there are certainly chemicals out there that are bad, right? I mean, it is important to be vigilant about that. And there are times when, you know, there's a degree of like everything that you hear from Maha, they like, oh, you know, we rely, there's too many chemicals. The sort of lobbyists are too powerful. The public health establishment gets things wrong. There's like at least 10% of truth in all of those, depending on where, you know, or there are instances at least where you can find that to be true. But they take it way too far. So, you know, the glyphosate, you know, as an example, this is not my expertise. So I'm going based on what other people, but I know a lot of people who are smart, who are, I would say are strong environmentalists. So people who care about polluting the land, who care about health, who would say, actually, it's not that, it's really not so worrisome. So like you were saying, and there's a trade-off, as you were saying earlier. I mean, the trade-off is, you know, we can feed more people. So, you know, that is a case, you know, where, you know, who knows if that's really so dangerous. But then there is, I think you were getting at something really important, which is they have this mentality that if it's natural, it's better. And in fact, yesterday there was an influencer, and his name is escaping me, but he was a prominent Maha type influencer who was explaining that he'd been asked in an interview whether he thought he wanted his kids getting a polio shot. And he was like, I want my children to get infections the natural way.
Oh, my God.
That's how it's supposed to be. And,
oh my God.
You know, there's this mentality that we're stronger if we acquire natural immunity, by which they mean you get sick. You know,
that raw milk does not kill me makes me stronger, said Nietzsche. But of course, a lot of the time it did kill you.
Yes, yes, exactly. It kills you part of the time. That's bad. We should stop that. You know, we don't want you to die. Yeah, you know, I mean, we could have a survival that we could be very Darwinian about this. And, you know, we could sort of write off, you know, X percent of our children.
Yeah, 6 out of 10 kids, you know, that's great. Yeah. You know, you still got 4. What are you complaining about?
I mean, that when you the batting title in baseball, 400, I mean, that's great. Me, I look at that and say, I'd rather go for 1,000. I mean, we can do it. You know, the vaccines work. They're very effective. They've been tested. And, you know, it's hard. It's so hard to have these arguments because, you know, the world of science is never, almost never black and white. It's almost never 100%. Even the most certain things we know is 90%. Every now and then something's going to be wrong. Every now and then you're going to discover something 20 years later. And that's just the nature of things. But you go with your best evidence. And it's I do think there is this mentality for it. I don't want to call it eugenics, although some people do. I do think there is a mentality in some parts of Maha, and I don't know, I don't want to assign this to any particular person because I can't see into anybody's soul. I do think there's a little bit of a kind of, we're stronger as a species this way because, you know, yeah, you know, we need the herd kind of gets culled a little bit, but then we all acquire this natural immunity and it makes us stronger.
Oh, so yeah, the RFK Jr. Uber mentions.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and then, you know, and that's, I guess, you know, then we end up with a bunch of people who are ripped when they're 70 because of the supplements they take. And that's a whole other story. Like, they have strange double standards for what counts for evidence. Like,
yeah, what's natural about shooting yourself up with steroids, I wonder?
I mean, right now, you know, they're in the middle of this thing right now. This is a thing that's going on. This is ongoing, unfolding, where... you know, there are these peptides, you know, a peptide is a broad description, you know, insulin is a peptide, you know, it's a sort of description for, you know, a certain kind of molecule, you know, the substance you can get, but there's these sort of unlike, you know, there are versions of this that people take for wellness and they're not licensed. And, you know, Kennedy wants to push to make it easier to get them and make it easier for pharmacies to compound them and make them for you. And like, there's like really good reason to question whether these are effective. And there's really serious safety questions. But for some reason, the scrutiny, they we don't need to apply much scrutiny to them. We can just, you know, we can kind of let that sort of let it fly. We don't need to check that so carefully. We can just rush that through the approval process. But vaccines that have been studied relentlessly for decades, those we know there was one study 50 years ago on an observational study.
With
12 people. That's a reason not to do the vaccine. And no, it's a little like, okay,
it's unbelievably disingenuous. Also, can I just rant for 1 second about fads?
Please.
Because I have been somebody who's been following like health advice that's in out there, you know, in the newspapers and in media for decades. And so I have become immune to claims of the new miracle drug or the new superfood or the new diet. I've been seeing these things for decades. And you always find that when enough time goes by, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, that cabbage diet, it turns out, you know, it can acidify your stomach and maybe that's not so good. And then, you know, et cetera. And then the next, you know, fad comes along and it's just, I ignore it all now. Not all, you know, health advice, but like the faddish diets and the superfoods and the supplements. Americans are mad for supplements. Okay, now I'm going to insult everyone and I'm going to get so much hate mail. But honestly, okay. I think people want shortcuts, right? It's like, exercise and diet, it's so much work and it's not fun. And, you know, if you tell me that I can take this supplement and it will increase my muscle mass sort of magically, that sounds good, you know, or this take this fat burning pill, you know, and look, watch your belly fat melt away, et cetera. People want shortcuts. People also want somebody else to blame. So if I'm not healthy, now there are plenty of people who aren't healthy for reasons that have nothing to do with their own behavior or choices. God knows. And, it doesn't apply to those people, but I'm talking about healthy people who, you know, have type 2 diabetes because they're overweight and they don't exercise and they eat wrong or they drink too much or whatever. And they, you know, want to say, well, it's corporations that are, you know, they're producing too much junk food and it's too irresistible. And that's why I'm unhealthy. And I think we should all eat healthy. I have trouble when I go out to like fast food places and finding something that I can eat. Like I want something healthy or at least reasonably so. And it's sometimes hard to find. The great American diet is terrible. But you know what? If consumers demanded more salads, more healthy options, more fruits, guess what? Companies would provide it. And so, you know, I mean, it's just, I get very impatient with people who just want to find somebody else to blame. Okay, now I'm going to get so much hate mail. And I don't mean to say, again, I don't mean to say that, you know, if people are sick, it's their fault. Please don't write to me about that. I didn't say that. There are some people who have terrible diseases, cancer and other things that are just horrible, and other things, a million other things that people get. But I'm just talking about things like being overweight or being, you know, having type 2 diabetes, which are highly correlated with behavior.
Yeah. I mean, so here's how I'll push back a little bit.
Okay. Not, do so. Not, go
so,
ahead.
So I'll push back a little bit.
The viewers will thank you.
The viewers will thank you. But only partly. So here's where I'll push back. I think behavior is tough, right? You know, there's a lot of lifestyle. There's two things. Number one, correlations between lifestyle and outcomes, they're there. But there's a lot of genetics in there too, right? There's a lot of environment. So there's that. So like, it's hard to disaggregate that in any particular case, I find.
What do you mean by genetics?
So some people have genetic predisposition to high cholesterol, right? Some people
agree.
You know, and that's, and you were, I think, saying that.
Absolutely.
And then you were stipulating that.
Right. But like some people say on the genetics thing, and again, I admit to being really crotchety about this, but like, if you look at the number of Americans who were obese in the 1960s and you compare it with the 2020s, it's like a steep rise, okay? That cannot all be because everybody's genes changed.
No, for sure.
Okay.
Not arguing with that. what I would say, there are a lot of choices we make in public policy, and there's a lot of that end up having influence over this in lots of little ways. We have places, less so now because we've paid attention to it, but there were places. I remember when I was working on one of my years and years ago, I did a bunch of research in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles. It was actually back then hard to get fresh produce in certain parts of, like, if you were living in certain low income, there weren't stores. Right. And it was expensive. And I remember the reason I learned about this is that there were clinics. They were like health clinics. And one of the things they started doing was they started holding farmers markets to like mm-hmm. get people fresh fruit, and they would have cooking classes, and that kind of stuff worked. Like, it had an effect. Like, being able to intervene in that way was helpful in a way that also made me realize that, okay, you can be trying to do the right thing here, but it can be, you know, where you live, your environment can make it harder on you to do that.
It surely can. Yeah. But I don't think most Americans live in food deserts either.
No, they do not. I was just using that as an example.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I think, because I think about this a lot in the context of which is an interesting topic that I am still tossing over my head. So I don't know what I think about all of this exactly. And you may have also thought about this, which is in the context of these GLP-1s, the Ozempics, that, you know, with the weight loss drugs. And there's, you know, like a kind of a meta debate, like, is that a shortcut or whatever?
No, I think it's great.
I do too. And I've kind of, I get the arguments too. So I just think this stuff's pretty complicated. But where I was going to go without having, that was my throat clearing for where I was going with this, is that, there is like an attempt to blame, you know, people for, you know, there's a, you got to have something to blame and everything's the fault of corporations. And look, I'm kind of a populist lefty by nature. So it doesn't take a lot for me to like get angry at corporations, but you know, that's like, not only gets you so far when you're talking about health outcomes. They are looking for someone to blame. And it's amazing. Like the whole vaccine thing is couched as, you know, this is, if you follow the vaccine debate, it's always big pharma is pushing vaccines on you. Because, you know,
it makes so much money on them when in fact they don't make money on them. In fact, we have to have a government program to help them because it's not a moneymaker for them. It's a one shot, you know, thing. Whereas, you know, like, what is it? Viagra. Now there you can make money forever.
Lots of money. You can make lots of money. I see the ads on them all the time. Football game, basketball games. It's hard to penetrate that. Web, because I mean, you can see how this sort of, it becomes this sort of conspiracy theory and pharma's, you know, has a sort of stock, you know, has infiltrated all the agencies, you know, the FDA has sold out to pharma and the NIH is, and you can't trust them in these people, you know, and again, like the reality is there is a sensible version of a critique of say the FDA that says it leans too far, you know, it is, you know, there's too much, you know, it's not skeptical enough of the drug industry. I don't know that I believe it, but I think there's a credible version of that. But then the way you deal with that, and it's someone has been dealt with, you know, is by you have conflict of interest rules and you're very careful about who you appoint to things. Whereas you don't, you know, their answer is, well, there's maybe too much, you know, corporate influence at the FDA, so we need to get rid of vaccines. Like, that's nuts.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is what's going on. And it's very frustrating because you get to the point where if you say you're in favor of vaccines, oh well, you're just a shill. You know, I see this all the time from I follow now on Instagram. I follow all the medical influencers on both sides, and it is the absolute, like, if you are a doctor and you speak out in favor of vaccines, you will be attacked immediately. Pharma shill. You're a drug company shill. You're out for the drug companies, which is kind of hilarious because a lot of these people in other contexts are actually quite critical of the drug companies. But no, you know, you're pro-vaccine. You must be a pharma shill. And that immediately shuts down the conversation. Like, you, that, this like a way of saying, don't trust this person. It's very frustrating.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the awful news. And so let's turn now to some of the pushback that's been happening. So for one thing, polls show that still a big chunk of Americans are pro-vaccine and even think that vaccines should be mandatory in elementary schools, right? So yep. That's a good thing. And then there is, by the way, even among Republicans, so a majority of adults across party lines, 90% among Democrats, but 68% among Republicans think that it should be required, mandatory, to inoculate children. So that's interesting. Also, they seem to be pulling back a little bit on the anti-vaccine stuff. I mean, Tony Fabrizio, who's one of Trump's pollsters, apparently circulated a report internally that reflected, I'm sure, some of these same poll results and said, this is a political loser. And so apparently the word went out from the White House to kind of soft pedal it. Is that what you have heard?
Yeah, yeah. I think you could tell a very kind of coherent story that, frankly, I think has broader, will resonate if you've, with many other parts of what is, you know, many other parts of the Trump agenda and what's gone on in the Trump administration, you know, but the, you know, the story very roughly, I think, goes like this. Kennedy comes in and he just, you know, blows everything up, right? I mean, you know, they lay off a quarter of HHS. He purges, you know, all the senior leaders who might stand up to him. He basically
fires the panel that gave advice on which vaccines to approve, fired the whole panel.
Yeah, the advisory is called ACIP. You know, he fires all the scientists on ACIP, which has never been done. ACIP, you know, it's a voluntary thing. You serve for a couple of years. It's this kind of rotating group of scientists. no one's ever come in and done this before. He fires them all. He packs it with people who are one way or another, almost all of them, you know, sympathetic to his view on vaccines. He proceeds to make these changes, you know, everything from what we were discussing earlier, you know, to sort of changing the actual vaccine recommendations to putting out misinformation. I mean, the one thing on the autism was he didn't declare that vaccines cause autism, but the CDC webpage today, unless it's changed since I looked a week ago, still says, actually, we don't know if vaccines cause autism. It's never been fully studied, which is wrong. It's been studied extensively.
Right.
And just moved ahead in a way that I think a lot of us didn't think was possible. He just, you know, the institutional political controls on action just fell apart. He fired the CDC director when she wouldn't just sign off on his new vaccine recommendation. And by the way, there's a new, just recently, New York Times, which has been doing these oral histories of parts of the Trump administration. It's a really nice one in the opinion section where they interviewed, based on interviews of 40 people who were in and around CDC. It's a real nice kind of walk through everything that happened. If you want to check it out, you can see it. And it felt like a lot like what they did with DOGE and the rest of the administration. And some of it was part of DOGE. I mean, there was overlap there. You could see as this was going, kind of getting to the fall already, you were hearing rumblings from inside the White House that their own polling was starting to show that people were like, I don't know about this. And, you know, I don't know if it was the fact that we were having these measles outbreak that were making people pay attention, how much just it was in the news. He was in the news a lot, Kennedy, right? I mean, the Tylenol announcement, firing the CDC director. It was like every month there was an explosion of controversy and it was not playing well. And you kept seeing these leaks about certain, you know, it was unnamed. You know, you assumed it was someone like Susie Wiles. I don't know if it was her, but, you know, people saying, we're not so, you know, Kennedy's a little bit on his own out there doing his thing. We don't necessarily endorse it. It was a little hard to rein it in because Trump personally, whenever he got involved, was clearly very, you know, he liked what Kennedy was doing. I think he himself has, I don't want to call him vaccine. Yeah, he's got his own, he's been had a kind of vaccine skeptic streak his whole career also. So
absolutely.
I think this played into it.
Yep.
But
he
the message
him
I got
a good conspiracy theory.
Doesn't he? It was funny that it was a very, if you were following the breadcrumbs, it was like a very clear pattern. First, there were stories, which I can't remember if it was the Politico or the Post or the Times, but there was a series of articles, good four or five of them. White House is looking, it was very clear, carefully phrased. White House wants Kennedy to focus on his food agenda.
Yeah.
And maybe play down his vaccine agenda because the food stuff is popular. It's less controversial, although there's plenty of controversy there too. But, you know, there's some, you know, healthy eating, healthy exercise, great. I mean, you know, look, if he was doing, you know, a kind of Michelle Obama kind of stuff, you know, I think that, you know, get people exercising, you know, eat, you know, more whole grains and, you know.
Do you remember what Rush Limbaugh said about Michelle Obama and the rest of them? I mean, it was like she was, you know, she was a Nazi for trying to force them to eat healthy vegetables.
And now they're all like, you know, go Kennedy. He's like doing 10 times like more aggressive than she ever was anyway.
But by the way, one more thing, her advice was actually good. I mean, she was recommending fruits and vegetables. She wasn't saying, you know, that you that's fine to have French fries as long as you fry them in beef tallow, or that it's fine to drink Coke as long as it's made with pure cane sugar and not, you know, I mean, so her advice was actually good.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a whole story about like, you know, that was a careful, they did a whole careful scientific process to kind of come up with new guidelines, which is not what Kennedy did, but you know, that's a whole other story. So you saw those stories and then you saw some personnel changes. So some of the people who had been brought in by Kennedy left or were moved. And, you know, in every case it was so-and-so I had, it's a family thing or we have another job for this person. But, you know, after you see five or six of these people moving on, you think, that's interesting. Yeah. In addition, there's a guy named Chris Klomp, who is known to be one of the grown-ups in the Trump administration in the sense that he's more technocratic. He's a business, he's got some experience in business. I think people who know him say he's a good manager, which is not something you hear about a lot in the Trump administration these days. And he was kind of dispatched to take a higher role at HHS. And around that time, you started to notice a bunch of other changes, much less of this sort of aggressive messaging on vaccines. Callie Means, who is the brother of Casey Means, who's the Surgeon General nominee, who's very controversial in her own right. And Callie is a advisor to Kennedy, has gone almost dark on his tweets. He used to tweet all the time, and you know, he's very aggressive, very online in the way the Trump world is online, and he's kind of gone very quiet. And it does seem like they are trying to rein things in. There was a big reversal of a decision that came up where Moderna, this was involving an FDA issue, but Moderna, the same company that made the mRNA vaccines for COVID,
yep,
had been developing a flu shot. They were ready to submit for approval. And FDA, which was then run by someone who's not there anymore, basically said, we're not even going to look at your application because supposedly, you know, there was some deficiency in the application. It is a step FDA almost never takes in a case like this. And only, you know, and it was a very chilling decision because it basically said to the entire drug industry that you can kind of go through the drug development process, which is very long. It's very risky. Very expensive. You can check all the boxes. You can do everything you're supposed to do. And then because FDA happens to have somebody who's got, you know, whether it's because Kennedy wants it or the FDA, you can just have the rug pulled out from under you. That's a very chilling thing because you got to raise a lot of money or invest a lot of money to develop these drugs. You're not going to take that risk because there's other drugs where you can put that, your Viagra example being one, where you get, it's a bit of a safer bet. That decision got reversed. And there was a number of signs now that basically people who were sort of driving the anti-vaccine agenda, a number of them have been sidelined or at least told to keep quiet, which does not mean that Kennedy is still there. He still seems to be moving forward with his agenda. And of course, it's hard to know how much of this is, don't rock the boat until November because we have a midterm coming up and then you can go wild versus trying to kind of actually move policy. But there's definitely been a shift and there's been some pushback.
So that's something.
It is something.
All right. Well, I think we have covered it and we've ended on a somewhat optimistic note. So
I should mention, do you want me to mention the legal, because there was a big legal setback. That's the
there
other
was.
One.
I am a little skeptical that that's going to hold. I thought, you know, that decision was kind of a reach on a few levels, especially the standing issue. So
yes.
I don't know if that will really hold, but go ahead. Just give the highlight. And you know,
I'll give the highlights because the caveat, you zeroed in on exactly the issue here, which is this is a ruling by a district judge in Boston who basically put a stop to those vaccine recommendations we were talking about earlier and several others because he said Kennedy did not follow the right procedures for making all these, you know, when he fired, when he put the new people on the panel, when they justified this change to the vaccines. There are procedures in place for how you do this by law to make, mm-hmm. you know, because the idea is it's supposed to be guided by science. And very clearly, that's not how this was done. That part, I think, is rock solid.
Yes.
I don't think there's any question that they did. The question is, does the law really, A, prevent that? That's a little fuzzier. And B, the big issue, at least according to lawyers I talked to, is exactly what you said, which is who has standing to challenge this? And this could get tossed on standing. So that this ruling may not keep. But it was a setback. And for the moment, at least, those rule changes are not in place because of this court ruling.
And if the administration is looking for a convenient way to back away, they can cite this, they can fail to appeal and just let that be their excuse for not pushing forward on these things, which they fear, rightly, are politically unpopular.
Yeah.
So there's that. All right. Jonathan Cohn, always a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Always a delight, and a delight to talk about your grandchild.
Oh my gosh,
I've seen the grandchild, greatest. Adorable. So,
my gosh, he is the greatest thing in the world. So, thank you.